Father John A. Hardin, S.J., is a well-known author, lecturer, and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises, and is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. The following conference is one of a series of conferences given by Father Hardin on Oriental religions. Father has for many years studied and taught about these divergent beliefs of the peoples of the world. He is the author of the book, Religions of the World. Father first engaged in the teaching of these religions to Jesuit scholastics to prepare them for missionary work in the East. Father Hardin is a well-known authority in this field and brings out the truth and error in each belief. In the following conference, Father speaks on the subject, Islam Beliefs and Practices. Father Hardin.
Now something on the angels without dwelling on it. Yet, if we don't talk about the angels, we're not talking about Islam, because they're all over the Quran. There is a remarkable angelology. 30 of 100 whatever surahs there are, 30 speak of angels, 12 of the jinn, G-I-N-N, created like men but of fire. Now most of the jinn seem to be either evil spirits or disembodied human beings. The function of the angels, this is the good angels. They are messengers of Allah. In other words, they are the way, the ordinary way, in fact, in which God communicates with mankind. It was, as Muhammad believed, the way that God communicated to him through, of course, the angel Gabriel. Now, this again brings out a facet of Islamic thought that we could pay more attention to. And when I see, as I do see, an undercutting of angelology in the Catholic religion, I am terrified. It's of the essence. We cannot do without the angels. They're just too much part of our faith. And because we are such empiricists, we want to see in flesh and blood any communication from God. Let's not forget that the scriptures are full of communications from God through angelic powers. You can't read the apocalypse without being overwhelmed by the belief in a world of spirit. And this is again what I, when I see this, and going over a manuscript recently and censor for the publisher, which is to be in ecumenical things, and undercutting the angels for ecumenical purposes. Well, my reaction to that is, you couldn't be less ecumenical. You don't talk a lot about angels. You cannot talk to a Muslim and be listened to. Well, for that matter, the whole Eastern world. In other words, the undercutting of angelology and of saints, and for us, sadly, in the Catholic Church, is typical of our matter-ridden Western civilization. If we want more of it, okay, let's have it. But we are losing the East. Not to say we are losing our hold on the essence of the Christian faith, which spans both worlds. It's not one to the exclusion of the other. It's the inclusion of both. They are the upholders of the divine throne. In other words, they are those who worship God. And their main purpose is, I might have inverted that, in fact, I should have inverted that. Their main purpose is to worship God. They descend to earth with God's decrees. In other words, a person, a Muslim, just believes that he's received a divine communication. And that's what you find in Quranic, many Quranic passages, and even now, the Muslim commentators, for example, they will speak as comfortably about receiving a divine revelation through the angelic spirits as we would of reading a book and discovering something. They record men's actions and on Judgment Day, dramatic passages. Now, some of this, of course, has been drawn from apocryphal writings, but there is much there that especially is based on the apocalyptic writings of the Old and New Testaments. Receiving souls of people when they die, they witness pro and con for people in the last judgment. And I don't want to read at length now the description of how they, maybe I can quickly find the way in which the angels are they stand guard. I've got that over the gates of hell. I think it'll come up under eschatology, yes. I bring the angels in there to make sure that we see they figure in everything Islamic. The jinns may be called devils. I think I would qualify that now, because while they may be devils in the sense of somehow having been created only angelic, only spiritual, and rebelled, or they may be human beings who are now disembodied and are the rebellious spirits, I think they can also be the equivalent of wandering spirits. Spirits, in other words, that are not necessarily bad. A kind of purgatory. They either oppose the prophets, or at least they make the work of the prophets difficult. They teach sorcery and will go to hell with the misled people. The question of how long they're going to stay there is part of the problem of Muslim eschatology. Eternal for some, temporary for others. Now, just a word about Revelation and prophets, about which you have a couple of lines in your notes. You see immediately that the Quran, not unlike Hinduism and Buddhism, is based on revelation. In fact, the main single thing I want to get across to you in these very short 2 weeks is to make you more deeply aware than you've ever been, I hope, that the religion of most of mankind, because although it took us only 2 weeks, or we were spending only 2 weeks in going over these people, their total number is almost 2 billion. That their religion is based on some kind of communication from outside of man, or independently of the empirical world. In other words, as a counter-agent, than which we need nothing more in our own United States, a counteragent to believe that man's own mind, his own natural faculties, and the resources of the nature that he handles are all that he needs either to use or to know reality. That most of the world, led by God as we believe it is, simply does not know that language. That religion at its essence, at its heart, at its core, is the profound belief which you don't begin even to prove, you just assume it. As I'm told by Orientals, it's like the breath you breathe, that the world you see is only part of reality, and consequently that revelation has been received from a world which is real and which is not just man's mind reflecting on himself or his own nature. There were therefore prominent prophets before. There was Abraham, and from Abraham to Moses, although Muhammad talks more about Moses than Abraham. There was Jesus, and then Muhammad. All of them were great insiders, so to speak, seers of reality. The Quran counts 28 prophets, excluding the 29th, each adding to the former, and he claims that Jesus foretold the coming of Muhammad, and somebody asked me, I'd say the clearest passages are those that somehow foretell the Advocate or the Paraclete, which, of course, none of us deny. The whole question is it Muhammad? Now the eschatology. The eschatology of the Quran is, on the one hand, very clear. There is no more of incarnation or maya or nirvana. Life is linear. Man's life in this world is a preparation for life in the world to come. And there is no coming back. There is a day of doom, which means a man's destiny is sealed. The last day is always terrifying, and the passages describing the last day, we're going to come to some. He was always present, it seems, in Muhammad's mind, and it runs through the Quran to a degree that we would never find, for example, in our own scriptures. There are whole surahs on the subject, the most important of which is Surah 81. I just hope that your translation is pretty good. It's so nice, let me read the whole thing. There are only 29 short verses. See what you have. Now, the question of whether it refers to the last day absolutely or the last day for each individual is irrelevant. In the name of God, as always, most gracious, most merciful. When the sun with its spacious light is folded up, when the stars fall, losing their luster, when the mountains vanish like a mirage, when the she-camels, 10 months with young, are left untended, when the wild beasts are herded together in human habitations, when the oceans boil over with a swell, when the souls are sorted out, chapter 25 of Matthew, being joined like with like, when the female infant buried alive, a familiar form of infanticide, especially for the poor baby girls, is questioned, for what crime she was killed, when the scrolls are laid open, when the world on high is unveiled, when the blazing fire is kindled to fierce heat, that of course is hell, and when the garden is brought near, then shall each soul know what it has put forward. So verily I call to witness the planets that we see go straight or hide, and the night as it dissipates, and the dawn as it breathes away the darkness. Verily, this is the word of a most honorable messenger, of course, Muhammad, endowed with power, with rank before the Lord of the throne, with authority therein faithful to his trust. And, O people, your companion is not one possessed. And without doubt he saw him in the clear horizon, Muhammad's having seen Allah. Neither doth he withhold grudgingly a knowledge of the unseen. Read the Quran. Nor is it the word of an evil spirit, a curse. Muhammad was not possessed. Then whither go ye? Verily, this is no less than a message to all the world. Muslim evangelism. With profit to whoever among you wills to go straight. But you shall not will except as God wills, the cherisher of the world. Now this could be expanded on, and the commentary has filled volumes. The outstanding, therefore, though many others, Surah 81. After death there will be judgment by two angels. Their names, for your information, are Munkar and Nakir. And they will judge a man on his faith and good works. Who will go there? Well, it's almost assumed, well, not quite. Well, of course, it is assumed that all Muslims have the true faith. So there's no problem of faith on their part. With them, it's only their misdeeds. So bad Muslims and all, and the Quran meant all unbelievers, will suffer the torments of the grave, whereas prophets and martyrs enter heaven immediately. Ambiguity on the resurrection has produced two opposing theories. Either that the soul dies and later rises with the body, or that it continues to live and will later be re-embodied, depending on the theory. Preludes of the general judgment include universal discord among the nations, the appearance of a mysterious beast of earth, and the coming of Antichrist. Jesus will return to earth to be slain. He must have read or had heard the apocalypse. At the first sound of the trumpet, the world will come to an end. At the second, the dead will rise and assemble on the plain of judgment. God will appear, and this every Mohammedan cherishes. God will appear between angels, and Mohammed will intercede for souls. Each man's guardian spirit, guardian angels, will bear witness to his record, weighed in the balance, and his book will be placed in his right hand, if blessed, otherwise in the left. And if a person sees the angel has the book, angel has his book in the left hand, then the consequences are dreadful. The souls will then start crossing a bridge as narrow as the blade of a knife, spanning the fires of hell, into which the wicked fall, but the good, with the help received from the prophet, will guide them by hand safely into paradise. Hell is described as a valley of smoke, where the damned suffer eternal hunger, burning and chains. They are fed with boiling water and the fruits of the cursed Zagum, Z-A-G-G-U-M, resembling the heads of demons and like molten brass poured into their bellies. Words fail to convey the horrors implied in such dire predictions as, quote, from the Quran, "The word of the Lord has been fulfilled. Verily I shall fill hell with the jinn and mankind together," or the observation, "One day we shall ask hell." Allah will ask hell, "Are you filled to the full?" It will answer, "Are there any more to come?" Paradise, on the other hand, is a haven of gardens and meadows, flowing with brooks of water and streams of honey, milk, and wine. Spreading lotus trees cast their cooling shade. The blessed, attired in rich garments and jewels, recline on silken divans covered with cushions and tapestry. They eat and drink to satiety, which they never did before, and never feel any pain. Now, Muhammad's presence. For companions, they have dark-eyed maidens and wives of recurring virginity. Their only spiritual joy is the mysterious presence of Allah. So honey, milk and wine, cool shade, eat, drink, dark-eyed maidens, and wine, plural of course, of recurring virginity. So much then for the eschatology. I guess you've got some passages there, don't you? Numbers 482, 462. Those might be, I stand correction, they might be references to my own book, The Religions of the World. That is my own book, sister, on religions of the world. At any rate, I didn't erase them because depending on when I teach the course, I think this is my sixth or seventh semester. Shall we call this a semester? Of teaching the Eastern religions. Now prayer. Ritual prayer, salah, and this is a sacred word in Islam, was first prescribed by the Quran and further defined by the earliest traditions, or sunnah. All Muslims are obligated to its prescriptions once they reach puberty and as long as they are in good health. The aged, infirm, travelers and others are excused only as long as it is impossible to fulfill the ritual demands. The rite consists of a series of seven movements or postures. I would, if possible, like you to get, the notes are there and I hope they're clear, but see if you can't get this because I need to memorize it. And the reason is because this really is what keeps Islam together. First of all, they're scattered all over the world where they're politically coordinated, as in Egypt or Sudan or Pakistan. They have, of course, ways of living, cohabiting, and as a consequence, at least living together and thereby unifying their religion. But they have no real authority. They have no structured morality. And even their belief is so variegated. But the one thing that keeps Islam together is its liturgy. This is Muslim liturgy. No believing Muslim, and I'm told none, fails to do this. And I'm looking forward, I honestly mean it, to Catholicism developing some counterpart of this. And if I should be accused of overstructuring the Catholic liturgy, amen. Specific times for specific liturgical actions and prayers, which the believing Muslim knows are being done by almost 500 million of his fellow Muslims throughout the world. The impact, I am told, on the human spirit is indescribable. All Muslims, therefore, are obligated to it. The rite consists of a series of seven movements. Let's make sure that you have this clear and that I am not saying more than, or not more, of course, but contradicting the notes. So there are seven movements, which may be called postures, joined to appropriate recitations, collectively termed a bowing, which is a rak'ah. And each salah, or prayer, is made up of a fixed number of bows. In sequence, the rak'ah, the bowing, begins with a recitation of the phrase, God is great. For this one, for this phrase, the hands are open on each side of the face. And you may see pictures in different postures. Number one. Then the recitation of the Fatiha, or opening surah of the Quran, and another passage, or passages while standing upright. So the person stands upright and recites the first of the, well, we have it, the first passage of the Quran. The third, pardon me, in sequence begin. No, that's number two, isn't it? And another passage, or passages while standing upright, then third. Bowing from the hips, then fourth, straightening up, then fifth, falling on the knees, and a first prostration with the face to the ground, which I think is the most popular in pictures of this. 6, sitting back on one's haunches, and the 7th, a second prostration with face to the ground. Okay? Only the first raka in the day requires the opening salutation. Only the first raka in the day requires the opening salutation. Second and subsequent rites begin with the recitation of the first Quranic surah, the first surah which you have in your own, that's it, the first text. So that beautiful one which summarizes, you notice, God's attributes and judgment and so on. And at each, so, with the recitation of the first Quranic surah, and at the end of each pair of rakas, and the conclusion of the day, the worshipper recites the famous Shahada. So, every time there is a pair of vows, and at the end of the day, the worshipper recites the Shahada. And this, of course, is the thing that most of us already know. There is but one Allah, Muhammad is Allah's apostle. Or there is but one God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Or messenger, prophet, apostle are synonymous. Together always with the ritual salutation. Then the person sits up and with upraised finger makes his private prayers. So after, this is public. When he finishes this whole business, then he sits up and with finger upraised makes his private prayers. And the finger upraised is a symbol of the one God. Set times for prayer. Now you see what this is, liturgy. Liturgy public to a degree which we capture to a certain extent, but you notice it's not public only in the sense that it's public 3 or 4 times over. It's public, first of all, that if whenever possible, it is done together physically. So a group together, there's a mosque around in Detroit, for example, and I don't know, all the ecumenical regulations of the Detroit Archdiocese, might be a good idea. You might hear with a chance if there's any need of clearing, but to maybe at least witness a ceremony in the mosque when they go through this. So if there's a mosque around, they do it together in the building. No mosque around, in the middle of pitched battle, I'm told, they will pause. And in modern warfare, between, well, gunfire, they will say, gentlemen, it's time for prayer. Set times, so they do it together. Well, first, let me elaborate. First, therefore, it's done together. Secondly, it's done publicly and done together. It is also done in a uniform fashion.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.